Hello and welcome to another webinar. And today we're going to be looking at technology and also reform. I have at the end of this chat the very latest on forthcoming reforms. The emphasis is on technology, and in the opening part of this presentation, my good friend here, Emma Ganley of Partners in Costs, is going to be looking at one area where technology has recently been introduced into the litigation process. That's the electronic bill. Later on, when Emma's gone off to work and do a proper job, I'm going to talk about the disclosure pilot scheme, the online court, what is and isn't happening, the whole question of is there a future for lawyers with technology, and I say at the very end, the latest, I have the benefit of some very useful briefings from the judiciary about what is happening in the next 2 years on reform. So that's our agenda for today. So Emma, who has done bills of up to multi-million pound sums, is going to just get us underway by first of all describing what's happened with the introduction of electronic billing and how that alters the game. And then we're going to have a chat about, well, what difference does it make and how might it actually benefit practitioners? Because I think there is a perception that it's an absolute pain and it's miserable, but there is another side to that story, we think. But anyway, Emma, so to business. And first of all, what you have here about the e-bill.
Yeah, so as most of you will be aware, there's been a change in the way that bills are being prepared for the detailed assessment process. It used to be very much an end-based process. You would carry on, run your case to a successful solution, send the file off to the cost draftsman, and that be that. By magic and all sorts, you'd come back with this bill, formal bill of costs. And there was quite a lot of criticism in the reform process. It was referred to as a Victorian bill of costs.
That was Sir Rupert Jackson, I
yeah,
think. Yeah, and Victorian accounting, and he said, I think he might have said that a legal bill in 2010 was indistinguishable from one in 1890. So
yeah, and I think the point I'd just make about technology and that in... I'm fortunate or unfortunate enough to have worked in costs for a while now. And I'd say there has been, it was maybe a little bit of an unfair perception. There'd certainly been some influence of technology before that day in the specialist cost drafting software. And for us older cost draftsmen, that was quite a sea change. I mean, there's nothing like manual calculations that were older cost draftsmen can talk to you about. But I think what was really the motivation was to stop it being a process that, if you like, started at the end and made it a more integrated process. Yeah. And the technology itself's not that really innovative at all, but what it's looking to do really is essentially merge the drafting process with the time recording process that's familiar to all solicitors.
And does, in fact, you prompt me there. So, and of course, I suppose also with cost management budgeting, mm-hmm. that also puts an enormous pressure at the outset on getting it right. Whereas, as you say, historically, people would run an action from beginning to end, and then they think about costs after it was all over. Whereas
Absolutely.
Now they must think about it from pretty much day one, certainly getting a budget put together. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously if you're in a world where there's a lot of private paying clients, and you know we're away from the CFA world, maybe a little bit in modern litigation.
Oh yes.
Then costs as a solicitor client act.
Yeah.
But I think it's the process of inter-parties costs that has been very separated, and it's looking to break down that separation. As you say, that started to a degree with budgeting. But really the method at which budgets was first prepared was fairly similar in terms of what was produced was different, but this perception that it goes to the cost draftsman, and particularly on the incurred costs,
right.
that would be there.
These are the costs of their pre-budgeting. Yes,
absolutely.
Yeah. Right,
yeah.
Okay. So we have that. So we have this sense of... Now you say... sounds good, but...
I mean, you can understand that in any process, one of the things that you'd be looking for technology to do is to streamline and make it efficient. And you can see that the process I've just described, and in particular when you couple it with modern time recording,
right.
you can see that there's the potential there to think there's significant duplication.
Sure.
And some of the biggest criticisms of the detailed assessment process are cost, time and delay. And clearly, if you've got... in the process of the litigation, the groundwork of the bill, hopefully all those things would be streamlined
right.
to a more quick and cheaper process
sure.
at the end
yeah.
of the day.
Yeah, I mean, Sir Rupert Jackson's sort of vision, which he told me about because I did a bit of work mm-hmm. with him, was that somehow the bill would work itself all out at the end if
yes.
people were to accurately record time. Is that actually happening?
I think it's a very...
Is that ambitious?
It's an ambitious process. It's requiring people to think about a case with hindsight, which is what a bill does, rightly or wrongly,
sure,
at the lifetime of the case. And we all know that in modern practice, the demands upon practitioners of running a modern case, relatively heavy caseload, and then also, of course, meeting demands from clients, mean that the administration side, which this is part of,
yes,
perhaps takes a little bit of a back seat. I mean, as much as I can give seminars till I'm blue in the face about solicitors' time recording, I still see not great time recording.
What's the most common, I mean, seriously, this, yeah, is very, very, because time is money, literally, is it not?
Yeah.
What's the most common error? There you are, this is something that practitioners...
I think there's a common problem in the billing process that's caused by a common error.
Right.
And the problem in the billing process is the bulk recording of time.
Right.
And
is that, for example, just saying, right, reviewing documents 10 hours?
Yes, and I think that what motivates that sometimes is retrospective time recording.
Solicitor,
in particular, perhaps in these days when solicitors are able to work more remotely, my experience with a lot of my solicitor clients, or certainly some of my solicitor clients, is that time recording doesn't necessarily get done at that point. It's been traditional for a lot of more senior lawyers to use the solicitor to use the secretary to time record, for example.
Yes.
If this, as we'll talk about in a second, if the process of time recording for the final bill is a more skilled process and is requiring maybe some of the skills that lawyers use about making decisions and about drafting, then clearly that needs to be done, if you like, at a different level and in a more thought using, if yes, you like, way.
Yes, yes. And of course, we've just had a court appeal decision, haven't we, about challenges on time,
yeah,
were disallowed because they were generic.
Yes.
And the beauty, the solicitors in that litigation were keeping excellent records,
yeah,
and being precise. And that's, I think, a lesson for everybody, that rather than saying, you know, perusing documents 2 hours, they were saying things like, this is Stuart's, of course, saying, looking at these documents in order to prepare this letter to send to whoever it might be, and in advance of the meeting with the expert. And that is, I thought it was really interesting reading the judgment in the Stuart's Court of Appeal judgment just published, that there was that incredibly specific and forensic recording of time. And I wonder, do you see that often? I suspect you don't.
I think it's an area of practice that's certainly improved massively,
right,
in the time that I have been working in courts. And I would say particularly in those fields of litigation where assessments are more common,
sure,
part of your work.
Sure.
You know, depending on what type of work you do,
sure,
more or less every case might have a bill on it compared,
yes,
to others.
Yes.
And I'd say maybe even in the very recent times, we're seeing certainly a little spark, peak in solicitor client assessments. I think,
yes,
most solicitors have thought they'd go through the whole of their career at one time with no Solicitors Act assessment. Clearly, that's an area of the market that's been targeted in some fields.
It's also a big growth area, isn't it?
Yes,
because if you're not getting all your costs back from the other side and you're charging your own client, then your own client is going to get very, very, very awkward potentially about having to pay money out of their own pocket.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that again is a growth area.
And so I think that's a lot of practices have been alive to that in the last few years.
Yeah.
A lot of, and so I would say that kind of attendant note processing in good practice,
sure,
is seeing its way through. Now,
sure,
in the days before the e-bill, I used to give seminars about that to people, talking,
yeah,
only about assessment.
Yeah.
I suppose my takeaway on the e-bill would be that's really going to bear you fruit in the billing process now, as opposed,
sure,
to just,
sure,
in those situations when we got all the way to,
sure,
a cost judge, which,
sure,
is less,
sure,
common.
Sure. And does, just one last question on this, does the technology make it easier for people to accurately record time and activity?
I haven't seen that we've really got there yet. I would say that the process of that, at the moment, most solicitors that I talk to on the front line say they find it relatively cumbersome, and the phasing and so forth.
Right.
The perception is there's a lot of clicking,
yeah,
rather than a lot of decision making. And I think whenever solicitors feel that something is administrative and time consuming, you know, they're, on the whole, particularly I think litigators,
kickback,
see it outside of the sort of thing that floats
them,
the boats.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, excellent. Right, phase, task, activity.
Yeah, so as we were just in fact touching upon, it was obviously essential that if the time recording was going to be the basis of the bill, then we had to have some kind of coding to make that yes. routine. And in particular, one of the, if you like, selling points of the new bill was intended to be that there was more specification on routine items. Before, right. you just used a, you know, I wrote 10 letters to the claimant and there was no more.
Yeah.
And detail, now because yes. of that. So certainly that's where the phase tactile activity, because the way that it captures that that information and turns it into the bill at the end requires that. There's a few problems that we've experienced to date with that. Number one, it's just time consuming. And a lot of solicitors and a lot of, if you like, if the aim of one of the main aims unquestionably is to cut the overall amount of time down, that's not really happening if instead of spending the time at the end, you're spending more time in the lifetime.
Yeah, but is it still time being expended and exactly. arguably wasted? Yes.
And the other point is that the phases don't necessarily work entirely accurately compared to how clients do. A really obvious example is a client meeting.
Yes.
You go to a client meeting, you discuss the things that are happening in your case. What that requires, if you're going to phase properly, is to come back and break that down between phases. That's something I do a lot as a cost draftsman.
Well, you mean, for example, you might be talking for a bit about disclosure
yeah.
and then a bit about evidence.
And understandably, the phases have to be relatively, you know, we can't have 9 million phases.
No.
And so most things come in the gaps between the two, and there's quite a lot of judgment to produce a really
yes.
good bill that I'd say stood up really well to scrutiny in how you choose to present that information. And maybe we're still at that stage because solicitors haven't done a lot of that work before, where that level of skill is certainly something that I find as a cost draftsman when I'm coming back to review time recording and train on it, there's still quite a gap there.
Yeah.
So there's still quite a big job happening, even where times that have been recorded on the phase task activity basis, which isn't happening universally.
Sure.
Even where there is, there's still a big review job because that isn't presenting the information in as good a fashion.
Right.
You know, and at the end of the day, a bill of costs is not a purely factual document, it is a pleading. That's not to say it's not accurate,
there's discretion
involved, and like any yeah. pleading that involves a little bit, I think there's this view that tech could do it in the same way solicitors had, I think, strive back from the idea you could have a really good witness statement from a number of drop-down boxes.
Correct.
As a draftsman, I'd say that's certainly true of the bills of costs as well. And it's if there's a lot of that work going on at the end, then this selling point of the bill is falling away a little bit, I think.
Sure. Okay. And so that refers to real-time information, yes?
Yeah, I mean, what is happening, I think, is the idea that you do the work and you record almost contemporaneously.
Well, that's probably because you're aware of it. And if you try to do it later, you'll have forgotten what you did.
But the reality of practice can make that relatively difficult when it's yeah. a more time-consuming task.
Sure.
And when it's a task that's requiring more judgment. It's yeah. one thing making sure you note down you've been to see the client. It's another
yes.
thing if you are making decisions about how that will sure. be presented to the
sure.
other side, I
sure,
think.
Sure. But it's best practice, would you say, to record on the day always?
I would say so. Yeah. But I would say that even when I'm recording my own time, yeah. I know I wouldn't sit here and be a hypocrite and say
no.
I'm perfect at that myself. Even as a draftsman,
modern practice makes it.
You know, the phone's going, the email's going, and it's very easy to get
yeah.
pulled in another direction in litigation.
Sure. Right, then we move on with your slides and we're on to shifting sands.
Yeah, and I suppose that, I mean, I think
what you've got in mind there?
Flagged that a little bit, that at the moment I think that if, as I said to you, if the e-bill process, all that does is change where time is spent, then a lot of the big incentives for this process aren't really bearing the fruit we'd like it to.
No, because it was supposed to make it faster,
cheaper.
More efficient, cheaper, faster, cheaper, better.
Yeah,
yes.
And I suppose that I feel that my takeaway at the moment is maybe the process is still very disjointed. And so the extent to which people aren't engaging with it early on means that by the time we get to the end, if you like, we're still running cases in the same way
sure.
and the tech isn't really influencing the process.
Sure,
and
sure.
then it's becoming onerous because we're like trying to work backwards retrospectively
sure.
and to get it in a format yeah. rather than use that as a tool throughout the process.
Sure. If there is one change that you could make to the e-bill, what would it be? Is there anything that you think is screaming for attention?
I think that the onerous nature of the number of routines and having to record them in that way, I would say, is a major time that I don't think particularly bears any fruit
no.
down the line.
Yes.
If you go to assessment before you'd give the judge a pile of the routine communications he'd flick through, and he or she'd have a feeling for that.
Yes.
At the moment, routine is, and the other thing I hadn't thought enough about how you do it, but it's producing a very bulky document.
Yes.
If I look at my desk at the size of e-bill documents and the size of old bill documents.
Paper documents, yes.
I know we're not printing, so we're not worrying about trees, but in terms of management of information, sure. One of the big selling points of the new bill is you can look at information in lots of different ways.
Yes.
But if what you've produced is so unwieldy that you don't do that, and it's quite interesting to look at that, but it's not really part of everyday process of assessment or process of your practice, then if you like, that level of functionality is just not needed.
No.
If what it's producing at the end is an unwieldy document.
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, there's obviously a little bit of bias there, because all of us who work in costs are used to seeing the old document.
Yeah.
So I suppose that the real measure would be how easy people who'd never worked with the old document found the new document.
Sure.
Because all of us, when we assessed our first ever bill in the old form, took time and then have learned how to look for time.
Look for the gaps and the challenges. Yes.
And the other thing I'd just say about the process generally, and this is not a criticism of the e-bill, it's just a reflection as a draftsman's point of view. When I am preparing a bill for assessment, what I'm doing is looking at the raw evidence that would be before the court and using that to inform my advice to my clients about what they're going to recover.
Right.
Literally knowing what's in front of the judge.
Yes.
If you take the cost person out of that process, because everything's time recorded, I think you'd be making that question of advising on the bill a very much more complex one. You're still going to have some recourse to the raw material, because at the end of the day, the e-bill process doesn't take away from the fact that what the judge is going to be relying on is the file of papers, be that electronic or paper, the actual, not just the attendance note, but the statement you produced and so forth.
Sure, well, more than one cost judge has said to me, they still love paper.
I think for all of us, that's just I don't think that's an e-bill issue. That's just a way of working issue for all areas,
sure,
I think.
Sure, sure. So how long have we had e-bills?
So we've had to use them since the 6th of April.
Of which year?
2018, sorry.
Yeah, thank
2018.
You. Right.
And obviously what's happened is, because a lot of people have chosen to use the traditional bill to that date, if you like, the first few bills you were drawing had very small e-bill parts.
Sure.
And it's only over time that we're seeing that.
Because the e-bills is for work done from 6th of April 2018.
I think that's probably one of the things they didn't anticipate would happen, but it certainly happened. They gave a transitional provision that allowed you to do that.
Right.
And certainly that's the way most people did it. And I think some of that's to do with the relatively slow take-up in practices. I think there was a lot of feeling that this e-bill wasn't maybe going to come off. And so I think solicitors were very slow, mostly. There are notable exceptions in the marketplace, to adopt it as time recording. And whenever it's not adopted at all as time recording, there's very clear reasons why you wouldn't try, in terms of the time that it takes to produce an entire new bill for a time when there's no time recording that reflects that.
You'd have to go back and redo the whole exercise.
Yeah.
That'd be madness, wouldn't it, really?
Well, it's certainly very time consuming.
Yeah, time consuming. And then just one more really important point that you raise, which is something completely beyond the literal bill itself. But you talk here about the bill being a practice management tool. What does it tell us?
You see, I think that is one of the really interesting things. And when I'm talking to firms, I'm not sure that that's really been embraced yet. But from a practice management point of view, it can be telling us a lot about cost recovery. I think a lot of my clients want to know what they're losing on assessment, which of their fee earners are running the cases more efficiently, where they're losing time. And the e-bill's a really good method of recording that information easily, rather than it being a very onerous task at the end of the particularly settled cases to go back and do that. And even, a lot of solicitors, particularly at the more junior end of practice, find doing the estimated costs of budgeting, you've got that gut and how much does it really take.
Yeah.
What the e-bill should be able to do, if you're using it correctly and feeding that back into your practice management information, is say, well, on a case where we had three experts, our time in experts reports was X.
Right.
And that information is captured much more easily than it being a mechanical process of going through and giving. I mean, I used to give clients that feedback, but it could be relatively time consuming.
Right.
Someone who's on the ball can be using that statistics base that's there in the e-bill.
Empirical evidence that says, in the last 10 cases, this is how much time you spent on this sort of activity or
And I think important issue. For practice where you've lost time, either because you under-budgeted or because you did a lot of work that wasn't recovered. Now, that's sometimes necessary, but if other people in your team are not doing that, what you can learn from it.
Yeah, yeah. So is it the case then that you think that cost lawyers can actually now do a lot more than just do bills?
Well, I'd say, I mean...
Are you asked to look at, go back and feedback to people?
I think
it
depends a lot on the practices. I mean, yeah. It's some work that people do, and particularly when you have really good, close client relationships. I mean, I think since the days of budgeting, for it to work successfully, you've got to have the consultancy. And certainly the reason I personally, and I know a lot of my cost colleagues enjoy costs, is that level of more analytical. And
sure.
If you like, costs is becoming more complicated, but because of that, like, real skill and understanding of litigation means that instead of just trying to get back money for solicitors, you can hopefully stop them losing so much by using what you're learning in the cost process to feed back to them.
That's a brilliant point, isn't it? So it's not only getting money in, but stopping money oozing seeping away. Yeah.
You know, I think that if you are taking the time to use the information that you're getting through the yield building process, that's got to be a really major advantage of it. It's still in its infancy yet, but I can really see that there's scope there.
Sure. And a final question, you don't see that this being abandoned and us going back to where we were?
Well, I never like to think that we're doing that.
No.
I think that people are coming around to it a little bit. I think that it's, as with anything, it's never maybe as bad as it was billed in terms A lot of people that I talk to in costs now will say that in preparing new electronic bills, the time is perhaps still a little bit greater at the moment, but it is falling down. And the incentives...
Familiarity and understanding and experience all come to the
and
fore.
And I think that is going back to the costs, information technology. Certainly, I think that's moving on to improve the way we produce bills. So things like phasing is becoming less administratively onerous because it's gleaning information about that all the time.
Sure.
So I'm not saying that, I mean, it's interesting that I think that I'd have expected us to be more comfortable with it than we are yet.
Yeah.
You know, we are
patently on top of it, but do you think some people aren't?
Yeah, and I think that even I would hope that I'm on top of it, but even I can say that there are times when it's very administratively onerous.
Right.
And it's really going to require, I would say some people have embraced it, but those people who are not embracing it, of which there are still plenty, particularly in practice and where information technology is maybe not. And the other point I'd say is that where I really haven't seen it work well yet is assessment. You know, only small amounts of cases go to assessment.
Sure.
But at the moment, I think that navigating the way around the practicalities of it on assessment, obviously there's only been, we've still in a relatively small number.
Yeah.
But certainly...
but that number can only increase, can't it, as more and more bills come
and
through.
And I think that for whatever we need to do, and I certainly haven't got the magic answers, I've certainly had a fair few assessments or heard other people have assessments where the technology's fallen down and it hasn't produced at that final stage, the ease that I think people expected it to.
Sure. Okay. Oh, thank you. All right. Well, that's great insight on from Emma Ganley there of PIC about electronic billing. I'm going to move on and look at the rest of the process and what's going on with technology elsewhere. But my thanks to Emma. Anyway, to continue, I'm going to be looking at other aspects of technology, and perhaps I should point out at the beginning that the overriding objective from April 1999 declares that one aspect of the court's obligation is to use technology where appropriate. And we are seeing technology in litigation. I'm going to talk about disclosure in particular. I'm going to talk about other technologies and how they can help us with the litigation process. I begin, though, with, because I dispel two lots of myths, as we're about to see. First of all, the idea that lawyers are has-beens or never will-bees or are an endangered species. That simply is not the case. I quote here from McKinsey, a very, very well-respected international management consultancy. They've looked at the legal profession in great detail and said, yeah, there are always things that can be simplified, but the art of lawyering is a very specific technique, and that is one that is not going to be outsourced, no matter how much for the foreseeable future artificial intelligence might be around. McKinsey's view, what 5% of jobs could be eradicated using technology, and my recollection of the McKinsey paper is that those jobs were at the bottom end, the things that were most susceptible, the simplest activities, frankly, were the ones that were most likely to be vulnerable. And there always will be shrinkage as we go. But that does not mean, I think, that technology is going to kill off lawyers. Technology should be regarded as friend, not foe. The other major point, this is no less than the mask, the role, Sir Terence Etherton. I attended the Oxford University Symposium on the 10th of June last year, and that was to review the Wolf reforms, which of course brought in the overriding objective 20 years on. There was the current MR and Lord Dyson, Lord Neuberger, two former Martha Rolls is present. Sir Rupert Jackson was there too. So it was Sir Francis Coulson. So a really big turnout of legal heavyweights. And what was, I think, the most interesting point of the day was the speech given by Sir Terence. And look at what he said. I must dispel one myth at the very outset, a myth which is widespread. And as somebody who talks to lawyers, who gives talks to lawyers on, 200 occasions a year, I can tell you this myth has got real currency. He said, we do not have, nor are there, any plans for a single online court. And that was, if we go back to Lord Briggs, he came up with proposals for an online court. The critical point is that the government was against any sort of nationwide universal online court. And if one thinks about it, it really didn't stack up. A dispute about a toaster between a consumer and a retailer, we're not going to put that in the same category as some profound argument about whether there is a resulting or constructive trust where money has been invested abroad by a broker and the broker has now disappeared. The sense that somehow we could shoehorn everything into some simplistic process, and even more so, I have to say, the judiciary kicked back massively. And I do a lot of work with the judges. I'm very sympathetic to the judiciary. They work very hard and they don't get paid enough. But the idea that judges would sit in a room and there'd be a Skype hearing, they said this is not going to work. I think they're quite right. In a case not so long ago, I noted that Mrs. Justice Yip took note of the demeanour of a witness when they weren't in the witness box, when they were in the courtroom. She was adjudicating upon a negligence claim, and she could gauge from looking at those around her who seemed to be reliable and who was not. That is not going to be achieved by some unclear picture. And judges said, we like to see people, we like to hear them. Of course, in the name of proportionality, there will be matters where it is a logical way to dispose of a case. It is cheap. In fact, the parties might want it. Do you really want to travel? And with courts closing, it could be a 40-mile journey to a hearing in an argument about a couple of £1,000. No. But critically, Sir Terence, coming back to his speech, which you will find, by the way, on the judiciary website, in that speech, he said there was a bold vision for a single platform for all manner of claims, civil, family and tribunals. The government have said no, and therefore we are back to individual discrete streams of work. And with that, the idea that, you know, courts are going to disappear and advocates and just sort of, well, that wouldn't be much of a role for advocates, but advocates, again, would be living in studios. I think that is now, I can say confidently, that is dead and gone. So the grand vision of the digital online court is not around, and there is no appetite, I can tell you, from the judiciary for anything like it to come back. That doesn't say that we won't have some technology. You will appreciate, of course, that we have, it is possible for a witness to give evidence by video link. The House of Lords, you'll remember, in the case of Polanski and Condé Nast, House of Lords decision, 16 years ago, allowed Mr. Polanski to give video evidence in a libel action against Condé Nast. So he was in France. He didn't want to come to England to give evidence because he feared that he'd be extradited to the United States, where he was wanted, having been convicted of sexual offences involving a teenage girl. So he didn't want to come to England because he knew if he came to England, there was a real danger that he wouldn't get back again and that he'd be extradited. So, and in fact, the key point why I mention Polanski and Condé Nast is that the House Lord said on that occasion that allowing somebody to give evidence by video link was not subject to some sort of massive hurdle that had to be surmounted. It was not limited to extreme cases. So you might, for example, have a trial come up and your expert happens to be abroad. Or you've got witnesses in litigation and they live in Australia. There is nothing wrong now, and the courts readily accept there is a healthy case for technology to be used there. So with that, we have already got technology in place. There are areas, for example, I think service by email, that can of course only be achieved now, and has always been the case, where there is consent to accept service by email. That is, I think, a startling example of us being behind the times, and I think I would suggest that service by email should be permitted, in the same way that service by post has always been a regular method of service. We should recognise reality, catch up and allow that. So that's one area of reform that I suggest is massively overdue. Now, what is going on out there, in particular the great work of Richard Goodman, is, of course, in Tribunal Service, is trying to enable people who are dealing with their own claims to do so in an efficient fashion. If we appreciate, of course, we go back to the Jackson reforms in 2013, we've seen the non-injury small claims limit go up to £10,000. So, of course, the consequence is that win or lose, you bore your own costs. We've seen the evaporation of legal aid, state funding in matrimonial matters, for example. So people are doing it, having to do it for themselves. And Richard's scheme, and I have to say he's been brilliant at this, has been to really just go back to basics and say, right, what can we do to make it easy, user-friendly, in the same way that you might just randomly order a book off Amazon, which I find probably the easiest thing in the world to do. How can we make it equally easy for individuals to present a claim or to defend a claim? We've got the online money claims service, which is roaring away hundreds of thousands of judgments each year. And that is because it is user-friendly. Richard Goodman told me, oh, there's a strange detail, but in, I think, Christmas Day 2018, 13 people successfully made an online application to get a divorce underway. And the key thing, this is a true story, the key thing about all of that is that they thought about it, right, how do we extract from a litigant in person, how do we extract the information that is essential? Not what they think is essential, but what in law is essential. So there's a lot of sort of careful thinking there about the best way to structure questions. And if you don't answer the first question, you can't move on to the second question. So extracting the information that the court would need to determine, and therefore with that, then you have this sort of consequential drip down effect as we work our way through the materials. So, and that is something that it shows it can be done. And efficiently, the rate of rejection on divorce applications has collapsed. The Goodman work, almost one in two applications were rejected. Now that rate is about something like a quarter of what it used to be, because if you ask the right questions, you'll get the right answers. So there is an example of technology working as it should. Sir Rupert Jackson, with whom I've worked since about 2010, has said on more than one occasion, I've heard him say, that it's an absurdity that we have any paper in litigation today. Everything, this is the direction of travel, everything should be electronic, from making the claim, filing the statement of case, filing documents. We'll come back to that when I talk about the disclosure pilot in a few minutes. All the way through the whole trial bundles, everything should be done electronically. And it is beginning in patches, in a fragmented fashion, it is beginning to happen. I was in the Supreme Court the week before last, and leading counsel, Sean Jones QC, Eminent Employment Silk, referred to a document in MS2, which I assumed was manuscript, but no, MS memory stick. So even the Supreme Court is catching up with the old ways of dealing with material and thinking, well, you know what? It can be done more efficiently. So that's just one example. Now, the current biggie is the disclosure pilot scheme. It came into force on the 1st of January of 2019. It is a two-year pilot scheme, so another year yet to go. And the essence of it is to curb disclosure, and with that, to keep costs under control by using methods, which I'm going to describe, to narrow down the amount of material that is swilling around. Because I think if you talk to cost judges, they will tell you that disclosure and documents is most often the key area of expenditure, the area of excessive expenditure. So with that in mind, the pilot scheme anticipates, for example, that when you serve, as you're required to do, your core documents, so-called initial disclosure, alongside your statement of case, you supply those documents, forgive me, electronically. The pilot scheme anticipates that where there are large volumes of documents, that we have recourse to electronic disclosure tools. And can I just very quickly mention the two primary pieces of kit on disclosure? Going back, well, over a decade now, we've had keyword searches. If I just briefly describe these, because it is important. Keyword search is where you think up a list of words that you imagine would be relevant to the claim. So it might be, you know, breach of contract, damage, repair, whatever it might be. And all the documents are scanned, and then the computer software, at the speed of light, will read every document in a way that a human would take weeks to do. In next to no time, the software identifies every document containing keyword, and will yank them out and separate them off. So it reads them and it does the legwork for you. And that's the sort of function where tech really does come in to support and assist the practitioner. More recently, we've had predictive coding, a more sophisticated method of searching for documents. So again, your software provider will scan all of the documents, and then some of those documents will be randomly drawn off, and you are then required to mark them for relevance. So if it was a 10, it was a smoking gun, red hot territory. If it was something inconsequential, it'd be a naught or a 1 or a 2. That information is then fed back by your supplier into the software, and the software, what you're doing, you are teaching the software to think as you think. And so armed with that intelligence, the software, I think it's genius stuff, the software will then know what you are looking for, what you are interested in, and it will pull out all that material. That is predictive coding. And again, in the disclosure pilot, the expectation, if you look at the detail, is that if there are more than 50,000 documents involved, then really we should be looking. That's sort of like the tipping point. It could be less, but that is the tipping point in favour of having electronic assistance with the disclosure process. Technology is used elsewhere. The surprise is actually in the criminal courts, because certainly in the higher criminal courts, in the Crown Court, my perception of crime is always a bit odd. But in the criminal courts, everything, all documentation is now encoded online. I mentioned that she was then Mrs. Justice Simler, now Lady Justice Simler, told me that because of this, she was on a train from, I think, London to Newcastle, and because she had all the documents on a laptop at her fingertips, she was able to write a summing up for a jury in a murder trial on that train journey. So it's not pie in the sky. I mean, I was very sceptical when people started talking about tech, but it is living proof. Alex Hutton QC, an eminent cost judge, but also a recorder, tells me it is brilliant when he sits as a criminal judge, because he's got everything there at his fingertips, and you don't have the rummaging around and ring binders and the sort of thing that today, to this very day, one still sees prevailing in the Supreme Court. Now, obviously, there was money then for the criminal courts. The concern is whether funding will continue to be available, because tech is expensive. It pays off in the long run, but and this is not a political point, but I think all governments of whatever hue tend to think short term, and it does require long term investment for things to work out. So that's really the caveat for the future. Will the money be there? And will they be prepared to spend as much money as is required to get good kit? One judge told me earlier today the concern is that the MOJ might cut corners and buy equipment that is just about passable, just about competent to do the job, but in a year's time it will be obsolete. It will be an old Sony Betamax recorder rather than state of the art. So anyway, so that's another concern, and nobody knows what's going to happen over the next 2-3 years in terms of continued funding facilities. More technology and guidance. Can robots be lawyers? That's a wonderful paper that I just briefly want to mention. And again, it reiterated the McKinsey conclusions that there are certain things that can be delegated to technology, but the art of the lawyer is vast. And talking from that paper, the ability to join the dots, tactical considerations, analysis. I've got an excellent example coming up, not from me, on that in a little bit, and generally constructive thought. And all those skills coming together is a tremendous human facility. So with all of that, again, we're back to the thought that technology is not going to do you out of a job, but it may actually make your job a darn sight easier to do. I then come to the great story of Mark Lewis, who acted for the family of Millie Dowler. And everybody will, I'm sure, remember a ghastly phone hacking activity, which in fact led to the collapse, closure of the News of the World. In that case, Mark told me he acted for the Dowler family, and it was phone hacking, so privacy territory. Naomi Campbell had recovered damages of £3,500 in her privacy claim, which went up to, people recall, to the House of Lords. 3,500. So that was, as in the loosest possible way, that was a precedent at the time. Mark, face-to-face, negotiated a settlement of £3 million with Rupert Murdoch. He sat down with Murdoch and he explained how the great hurt the Dowler family had suffered. Mr. Murdoch, I'm told, he had no involvement, no personal involvement, absolutely no knowledge of what was going on, but he was the proprietor, he carried the can, and he wrote a massive, massive check. I say that because if you'd sort of use some technology to say, right, what's this worth, then what would it look at? It would look at empirical evidence, it would look at other awards, and of course, since then, we've had the brilliant judgments by Mr. Justice Mann in the phone hacking litigation, and whole new levels have been set. But even there, maximum awards, what, £250,000 perhaps, something of that nature? So I only mention that because I think that's just the best example I can ever give you about the way that a human could come up with an approach that I don't think any rational machine would ever do. So that was a surprise and a half. Experts out there, the guru of electronic disclosure, Chris Dale, each year on his excellent blog explains what new developments are there, and it is an incessant stream. Things don't stop there. Rupert Jackson, I've mentioned, wanting to rid the world of paper. And, of course, another factor, which I've not mentioned so far, is that clients don't want to spend money. I don't think they ever did want to spend money, but there is more economic pressure now than ever before on practitioners. And even the biggest of big city firms aren't immune to clients saying, you've got to do it for less. We have a beauty parade, give us your best price. And why I mention that is that labour and the hourly rate is substantial. It should be for expertise. But equally, if we could reduce some of that cost to make it more attractive to the client, would that not be a win-win all round? So with that, that's where we are. One more point about the need to reform. Just one point about the disclosure pilot scheme, which is that it really came about because of costs pressure from clients. They were saying, we are sick to death of paying enormous amounts of money in litigation, and if you don't sort out disclosure, we will take our business elsewhere. And this is the general counsel of top 100 firms, and they're saying, for example, I mean, this is not exhaustive, but they might use arbitration rather than litigation. They might go abroad. We've got an English-speaking a dispute resolution court now, I believe, in Amsterdam. So there's real concern. And the judiciary reacted because the judiciary didn't want work to disappear. And of course, the legal profession didn't want work to disappear either. So with all of that, there's plenty in terms of technology going on and reform. But the critical thing is to see how much the government is prepared to commit. And just finally, there are reforms which have been mooted. For example, fixed costs in cases up to £100,000, as recommended by Sir Rupert Jackson on the 31st of July 2017. We are now in 2020 and we're still waiting for an MOJ response. We have got also proposals from Nicholas Bacon, QC, and Professor Rachel Mulheron to change damages-based agreements. That seems to be adrift at the moment too. And also, as I speak, perhaps not relevant to many people, there are supposedly road traffic injury reforms coming on the 6th of April 2020. What I'm being told by senior figures is that there is no way on earth that can go ahead, and that is going to be abandoned shortly. Not abandoned forever, but postponed. And that in part actually is because of technology, the need for an efficient portal so that people with minor injury claims who won't get legal costs will be able to make a claim for themselves. Without an efficient and stable online portal system, the thing will crash and burn. So there we are. Thank you for listening to me. And I hope that you can join us again. We'll have a full panel next time around when we're looking at practice and procedure in the business and property courts, which is, of course, the home of electronic disclosure and the pilot scheme. A reminder, as ever, that this is accredited to help solicitors meet the requirements for education. And with that, there is a quiz appended, get 7 out of 10, you're in business. This will be online for the next 24 months. And with all of that, I thank you very much indeed for listening to me. I thank Emma for her invaluable contribution. And do think about not just getting cost lawyers to help you with your bills, but maybe to help you with profitability too. I think that was one message I got from her there. But with that, I come to a conclusion. Thank you very much. Thank you.